Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to be with you this morning. We celebrate this morning the concept of fatherhood, which is totally appropriate to celebrate because fatherhood captures in a very unique way the wonders of God's expression to us as human beings. And so we kind of get to celebrate men today a bit because it's just us guys that get to express fatherhood, really, because we are uniquely designed to be able to do that in the way that really demonstrates the wonders and beauty of God. Let me explain a little bit, right? So how many of you guys have ever played the board game Risk? Anybody out here ever played Risk? Look at that. I love you guys. Risk is a crazy cool game. It's a unique board game. Basically, you have a board with the entire planet Earth laid out on it in countries, okay? And then each player gets a set of armies, little army guys, and some dice, and you put the army guys all over the board based on a set of random cards. And you're playing against other teams. And then what happens is the aim of the game is that you attack with a set of dice and you defend with a set of dice, and you've got to strategically move through the entire world, wiping every other person off the planet so that you ultimately end in world domination. It's a really, really awesome game. And so what the game is about is learning how to risk the right things and the right moves, not pushing too far, not risking things that shouldn't be risked, because the right risks end up giving you the right rewards, and the wrong risks end up seeming rewarding at first, but end up shooting in the foot. So a lot of times in the game of risks, you'll notice the novice players, because right off the bat, they're just going, man, risking everything, moving forward, and they feel great. But if you know what you're doing, you're sitting watching going, just wait. Destruction is coming your way. And then at the last moment, when it looks like their armies have spread across the entire board and it's all just blue, 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 everybody, and you're sitting here all in a little corner with all your little red guys, but if you know what you're doing, you go, now watch this, and you roll the dice and you wipe blue off the board and they end up being dead. And your reward for risking the right things is world domination. And who wouldn't want world domination? You see, because us men, we are uniquely wired for games like this, because internally, God has wired us ultimately to be protectors and providers. That's what we were wired to do. Our part on planet Earth in the relational realities of human to human is to protect and to provide. And in order to protect and to provide, we are therefore wired to be warriors. Because to protect against the dangers, we have to have this drive to want to be strong and want to be ready and want to be prepared. And to provide, we have to go out into a dangerous world and we have to conquer the realities of the dangers in order to bring back the rewards, the provision for our family. So God wires us with this desire to go out into danger and this desire to become strong, to overcome danger, to overcome the world, because that's how we protect and provide. Now, in that wiring, which is intended for the beautiful relationship toward our children, each culture throughout history has had a unique expression of this particular reality in men. It has given us a platform in which to experience that need to conquer, to overcome, to get out there and face danger. We've seen it in cultures in the past where tribes war against tribes, or we've seen it in cultures during the great global move years ago where guys like Napoleon and those guys just went out and took everything they could. The Roman Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, we saw men wanting to take everything. So oftentimes when culture expresses how we are to be warriors, how we are to release this desire to go out and to conquer, the version the culture gives us ends up skewing lots of what we end up doing. In our particular cultural expression, in the Western culture, in our modern day, there is a unique means by which, for us guys, the expression of being a warrior is handed to us. You see, as we enter into manhood, we stare into the grand jungle of opportunities and careers that lay before us. We don't go out with spears and kill deer and fight dragons. We don't do that. We go into the jungle of the career world, the corporate world, the ministry world, the nonprofit world, whichever one it is, and we are told that that is what we are to conquer, That is what we are to go and take. That's where our provision lies, right? I mean, if you want to eat, you don't go kill something. Some of us do. Some of us go hunt and kill. But for the most part, that's in Super Target now. And so you need to provide a bank account so that you can draw from that so you can go buy the meat from Super Target, right? And in order to do that, you go into that world where you get provision back. It's just a different form of hunting and gathering. And so we enter into that world, and as we go to fight, we are told in that world that the more you excel in that world, the more you become better and bigger and faster in that world, two things happen. You get more provision and you get cooler. You do. You become cooler. Everyone's like, whoa, look at him. He's a fast mover. Wow. I mean, he started here and now he's there. The big stories we tell are always like, that guy started at the bottom in the kitchen, now he owns 19 restaurants, right? It's always our story. Those are the big stories. So as we enter into manhood, automatically the culture lays before us. There's a big story waiting for you. You want to be significant? You want to be important? You want to be cool? Here's the deal. You work hard, risk everything to become the biggest you can in this world. Conquer it all. And if you do, you will be cool and, hey, you will have more than everybody else, so you can provide well for those people you're supposed to provide for. So it feels right. It feels good. Then the culture comes along, and this Western culture adds and feeds this idea with another idea. We call it the American dream, but it's really just a skewed version of the American dream. The American dream, in its essence, has a lot of healthy things about it. But what that's become for us is ultimately this, that you and I have the right, we are entitled to the idea that we are to pursue happiness and comfort. That is sort of what we define now as the ultimate end, right? If you can get to the place where you are totally happy and totally comfortable, and if you were able to create total happiness and comfort for those who you love, your wife and your children, your family, then you are the man, right? I mean, you've conquered the world. So you need to pursue happiness, you need to pursue comfort, and you do that by entering into this world, this jungle of opportunity, and you risk everything in order to move forward, in order to provide well, in order to become special, in order to be happy, in order to stay comfortable. And that culminates in he who retires earliest is coolest, right? I mean, you retire at 35, wow, I worship you. You retire at 45, not bad. 55, you're practically behind the curve. 65, oh, you're just normal. 75, what were you thinking, right? I mean, that's how our culture plays. And then fed into that idea, added to that, a whole new idea was born. In our consumer culture, in our materialistic culture, it started becoming like this. You want to know how you're happy and comfortable? You want to know? The more stuff you have, the happier you are. The bigger your house, the bigger your car, the bigger your television, the bigger your sound system, the bigger your boat, the happier you are, the more comfortable you are. The bigger your resource package, the more likely you'll stay comfortable because somebody somewhere is going to try to steal it all away. So make it really big and then you'll be really comfortable. We look into the magazines and see the guys with billions of dollars living in their giant houses with their computers running the houses and everything's brought to them and we go, now that is life. That is awesome. Who wouldn't want a 97-inch television? Who wouldn't want a movie theater in their house? Who wouldn't want to drive that car? Now, in of itself, none of those things are bad or evil. But what begins to subtly happen is that our entire manhood becomes defined by those things. Our entire pursuit becomes defined by those things. The warrior in us fights for those things because those things are worth risking for. Because somewhere deep down inside of us, we believe that if we risk everything for that pursuit, for the pursuit of happiness and comfort, for the pursuit of having the bigger, better things, then in turn, those who we love most, our children and our wives, our families, they will benefit from that pursuit. Just as in years past, if I went out and I killed the biggest deer or the biggest elephant, my family would benefit from that for the entire winter. And so we believe these pursuits are the things that should drive us, and we are driven and captivated by them. Now, I don't believe that men do not love their children. I don't believe that men do not love their families. What I believe happens is that in that complicated expression of our need to overcome, that oftentimes us men have a very, very difficult time figuring out what the world looks like in balance with our world and our children. Because subtly the culture does something else to us that's extremely damaging. The culture comes along and it says to us, now what is your life about? Well, it's about pursuing the jungle to be able to become the biggest and best so that I have the resources to be able to buy the biggest and best so that I can be comfortable and happy and make my family comfortable and happy. That is my goal. Well, I have a question for you. What do your kids do to that goal? Ooh. Do they help that goal? Are they an asset to you in that goal? I mean, think about it. You know how much time you have to spend with your children to make them happy? Well, that's time away from work, time away from the pursuit. It's not a good thing for you. I mean, do you feel the wrestle in you constantly, the guilt that you feel about needing to be home but yet needing to be at work? Oh, and that's right. What are you working for now? You see, now you're in your mid-40s. Those kids have moved into their early teen years and they eat like animals. They eat more food than's humanly possible. And you accidentally went and had four of them instead of the one that you were supposed to have. And so now you can't rent the apartment anymore. You can't live with the frat brothers for $100 a month. You got to buy a house. Now you got a mortgage payment and your house was smaller than the Joneses. So you bought a bigger one. Plus you had four kids. So you added them into the mix. Now that mortgage payment is heavy. And those kids need tennis shoes and the best shirts and the best clothes because just like you, they also are measured by what they are wearing and what they are doing and how big their stuff is. And at 16, each one of them deserves at least a car, probably used, but maybe new if you can afford it. And if you can't, I mean, who are you anyways? What kind of a parent are you? I mean, their friends are driving brand new cars to school. So you're working and working and working, but no longer for the big 60-inch television you want. Now it's for the stuff your kids want. And oh, college is coming. Holy moly. And it's not like they're working towards scholarships because they play video games now. And so you got to pay for the whole deal. And if you don't, people are going to look at you and say, can't believe you didn't educate your children. What kind of a man are you? See, because your manhood is defined by your ability to become bigger than everybody else and then provide whatever this family needs to be able to become bigger than you. And now they're actually competitors, aren't they? Because they're competing against your very drive. Plus, you're going to make them better than you so they can get better jobs than you so they can be cooler than you. It just doesn't seem right. So before you know it, in our cultural context, being a dad, being a father, shapes and changes from what the intent of Scripture was to this new hybrid version where in fact, children don't become an adventure for us guys. They don't become the thing we risk for, the thing we conquer, the thing we pursue, the thing we live to bring about. They shift to being a distraction and even a burden in some ways to the very pursuits that are ours. It is no wonder that we have this neat thing called the midlife crisis we've defined in our culture, where suddenly a guy wakes up and goes, well, hold on a second. You people are my enemy. I want a bigger car. And suddenly there we are. Now, you know where this cultural trend ends us? It's really cool. I mean, this is like the risk game where you go all out and then you find out that was the wrong move, right? That game ends us here. Listen to this. Sociologists today in America are working on coining a new term. I read numerous articles on this. That, you know, we have the term childhood, right? You've heard that before. Then we have the term adolescence. You've heard that term before. Then we have the term adult. You've heard that term before. And that's the sequence. The sequence is childhood to adolescence to adult. The strange and funny thing is that in biblical times, you only had two terms, childhood and adult. You had a child, and when a boy turned 12 or 13, they moved into adulthood. By 14, they were looking at being engaged. By 15 or 16, they were engaged and generally married and living an adult responsible life. Now we have adolescence that runs us from 12 till about 22, right? 25, somewhere in there, okay? It's the pre-adult world where you get to kind of be, I don't know what, but be. Listen to this, here it gets crazy, right? There's a new term they're trying to coin because they found a new stage in life among the men in America. Okay, they have childhood and then they have adolescence. And then from the age 18 or 20, when adolescence comes to an end, to age 35, there's a new stage now. They don't know what to call it. Okay? These guys, they don't grow up, they don't become men. They call it guyland right now. Just guyland, okay? That's their best term right now. And here's what guyland looks like, okay? many men now enter college, they come out of college, and they either move into one or two places. They move home, or they move into an apartment with their frat brothers, and they hang out there until 35. And what they do is they go find jobs that utilize the least amount of hours so they can buy ramen noodles and video games. No joke. No joke. And so what they do is they have this new stage in life where the largest consumer of video games is age 20 through 35, men. The largest consumer of sports events, age 20 through 35, men. The largest consumers of golf and sports equipment, men ages 20 through 35. The largest consumers of cars they cannot afford, literally that category, buying bigger cars than their bank accounts afford them and going into debt, men ages 20 through 35. Men don't marry now until age 28 through 32 on average, and they're shifting toward 35. They don't even start looking for that because they believe that the responsibilities of adulthood and of manhood are a burden, not a wonderful adventure. A wife and kids will bog you down. So they marry later and they have kids later. And many of them are thinking about not having kids at all. And so now they're trying to define this new stage in America. We've got childhood, we've got adolescence, that's a crazy stage. Now we need a new one for the continued immaturity that expands into the 40s, which leaves us also with a much larger group of single women than we've ever had in our history, because women mature at about 13, and then by 18, they're like, we're rock solid, and the men around them that are 23 are kids. So if they have to wait to meet a guy that's 40, that becomes problematic. That's our culture today. So it seems odd, isn't it, that we celebrate fatherhood, doesn't it? I mean, in our cultural context, it seems sort of odd that we come here and go, whoop, whoop, fatherhood, it's awesome. Let's celebrate it. Nobody likes it. So why do we celebrate it? Why? I'll tell you why. Because thank God the culture isn't the voice that should be defining our lives, right? See, what we have the privilege to know is that at some point during our lives, we collided with this thing called the gospel. The gospel was the good news of Jesus that in fact the life we're living is a skewed life. We're risking for all the wrong things for the wrong rewards, missing out on the right things for the right rewards. This is what the gospel begins to show us. It begins to speak into our lives and say, you see, you have to understand in the Garden of Eden, you were created to know God and to make him known, to live in every way through life, in every relationship as an adventure and a means by which you can express the wonders of God through human relationship, through actions and through words. That was your God-created purpose. And when we decided to pursue our own divinity in the Garden of Eden, we lost that purpose. We lost that beauty, that adventure. And in our lostness, becoming people that were disconnected from the freedom of God and therefore unable to express God, to image him, we began the pursuits of our own selves, our own divinity. We wanted to be our own gods, our own bosses, dictate our own schedules, make our own rules. And in that pursuit, instead of defining and finding divinity, we found death and destruction. The reward to that was death. The wages of that was death. And the gospel comes and says, but don't worry, because though you abandoned God, he did not abandon you, and he came and pursued you and rescued you from death, from the chasing after the wind, as Solomon calls it, and he brought you back into right relationship with him through his death and resurrection on the cross, reestablishing, reconciling us to God. And in that reconciliation, the gospel began to inform our lives again. The good news that redemption is freedom, and Jesus is king, and we are able to express him again. And so God redeemed or bought back those things that had been skewed and stolen by the enemy, including fatherhood. He said, oh, now we can look at fatherhood and ask ourselves, what is God's intent on this? What is the adventure that waits for us there? Is that central to our lives? Should it be? How do we utilize that to live within the freedoms of this new life that we're given? And what does this new life look like and how does it play out? So we discover our souls have been rescued so we can know God again, our purpose restored so that we can make God known again, and now we begin to look at life utterly differently. Suddenly, the pursuit of a career that we conquer, the pursuit of resources that make us comfortable, the pursuit of the large television and the big car no longer drive us. Doesn't mean we can't have a nice car or a nice television, just means it doesn't drive us anymore. We don't live to pursue those things. They don't measure our identity. And so we start asking a question. God, in this new life, this new land I live in of freedom, this new land of the gospel, what is it I'm supposed to do here? What does my life look like here when I'm living a life of adventure, a life that is conquering, a life that is overcoming? In other words, what makes me a man in a world of freedom, not a world of bondage? It's a good question, isn't it? What makes me a man in this new gospel-centric world? Well, as I dug into Scripture, looking through to see, God, how do you define manhood in this new world of freedom? I actually discovered it in a very strange place. I had to go all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy. And in the book of Deuteronomy, God describes there what a man should look like and live like in the land of freedom. But he describes it through the picture that he initially created to display the gospel that was coming. You see, God rescued the people from Egypt when they were stuck there, enslaved by Pharaoh. He brought them out of Egypt, guided them through the desert, and landed them in the promised land, the land of freedom. He gave them that land, and he produced for them within that land all that they needed, and then they lived in that land as people expressing God. And that picture of redemption with the angel of death passing over because of the lamb's blood on the door became the single greatest picture of the full reality of redemption in the gospel. So whatever implications come out of that picture apply also to this picture. You want to know what freedom looks like? Go and read about what freedom looked like there, and you'll see what it looks like here in very practical terms. So we go to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and we listen in to what God says is the new life in the new land under freedom as a man. And we begin to discover an adventure so exciting that it draws us and invites us into risking our lives for perhaps an utterly different set of things. And then we begin to discover the beauty of celebrating fatherhood. Watch. Deuteronomy chapter 6, page 97 of the Bibles under your seats that we provide for you. Page 97, or Deuteronomy chapter 6 in your Bibles. Now listen to this. This is what it says. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I commanded you all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Do you hear that? This is now Moses preparing the people to enter into a brand new way of life. They have spent hundreds of years in slavery. That's all they know. They know how to follow the structure. Do what you're told by the culture. Follow the ways. Do that. And now suddenly they're like, you're free. You're free from that. You're free from sin. You're free from the pursuits of your flesh. You are free now to choose some things. Well, what do I do, God? Well, here's where it starts. As you enter into this new freedom, fix your eyes on Jesus and begin to follow the things he commanded you. Why? Because your new restored purpose is to display God in all that you do. And how do you display God? You see, the law was given to us at first as a means to reveal to us that we are incapable of righteousness. And what the law was incapable of doing, because our sinful nature weakened it, was to rescue us. But once Jesus rescued us into righteousness, the law becomes our friend, and we are able now to utilize it to make the choices toward righteousness so that we display the freedoms of God. Because where righteousness reigns, freedom will come behind it. And so now we are called, live God's way. Live God's way. Do it God's way. Think God's way. So that means you got to learn God's way. You got to know the scriptures. So as men, our first call as we enter into this new land of promise, having collided with the gospel and being set free by Jesus, is get to know God and his ways in the word. And then live them out before the people around you. And then I love what it says here. And live them out before your sons and your son's sons, right? Gives two generations. Why do you think two generations? I don't know. Maybe there's some other reason, but the best reason I could see is this. What are the likelihood that you will speak into two generations? Pretty rock solid, right? I mean, sometimes it doesn't happen, but for the most part, two generations is likely. What are the likelihood you'll speak into three generations? Real, real small, right? Because even if you're alive, when the third generation arrives, they'll think you're cute. They won't really listen to you. You understand? I mean, at that point, you're in your late 90s, if you've gotten there, and they're like, oh, it's great-grandma, great-granddad. They're so cute, aren't they? See, that's where we go when we get there. And yes, there are a few things they might say that were like, oh, that was brilliant. But for the most part, you'll have the time in your life to deeply speak into your children and deeply speak into your grandchildren. And that's your privilege. That's my privilege. So he says, listen, when you enter into this new land, live a life that demonstrates the statutes and commands of God so that you speak into your children and you speak into your children's children. Then he goes on. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. So there it is, just a final summary of, look, point one, men, you want to be a man? Fix yourself on God and on his commands and follow him. Now look here, this is it. This is the next thing you should do. You'd almost expect them to say, now work diligently to provide for your family. But look what it says. And you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your head, and they shall be as a frontlet between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. I love that. What's the very first thing God says defines us as men and defines our adventure as men in the land of freedom? To know God and to make him known to who? To our children. It's a beautiful picture. It's like God is saying, I'm sorry you got stuck on the wrong adventure, but there's one that's risk is high, but its reward is worth it. Fix your eyes on Jesus and pour into your children. Now watch this. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to you, with great and good cities that you did not build, I love that, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, and when you eat and you are full, then take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. See, what he's saying here is this. When you enter into the new freedom, you don't no longer have to pursue your identity and your value in things like having the house and having the car and having the vineyard and having the stuff. Because now God has promised that in your pursuit of just living God's way, working diligently, being a man, he will provide for you things you can't even provide for yourself. But when those things arrive and your house is full, don't forget it wasn't you who made all that happen. It was God who provided that for you. See what he's saying? The second we men believe that by our hard work, by pulling our own bootstraps up and by doing our thing well, we provide for our homes. We are the kings of our homes. God goes, you've already lost the adventure. You're already risking for the wrong things. He's not saying don't live a life working hard and pursuing that. He's just saying be careful that that doesn't become your adventure. Because if that becomes your adventure, if that becomes your obsession, if you're captivated by the pursuit of the bigger, better, career, stuff, house, whatever, then you will by definition miss the grand adventure waiting for you. And if you're not careful, before you know it, you will see God's adventure as a burden. It's a crazy idea, but it happens. Watch. It is the Lord your God, verse 13, you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. Isn't that a fascinating statement? You are constantly going to be informed by your culture, who are going to tell you what makes you valuable, what you should pursue, what manhood looks like, and how you should play. And currently our culture says this to the emerging generation. If you own the best video game and you have a job that leaves you home to play video games more than anybody else, and you can say, dude, look at me, I'm free, I can do whatever I want, I have a cheap rent, I live with a bunch of brothers, and we drink all that we can while playing video games, and I work so little hours and I make enough money to still live, look at me. That's what our culture now tells us is true manhood. It's crazy, isn't it? And he says, man, when your culture tells you, these are the gods you are to pursue, these are the things that will make you valuable, do not buy into their ideas. But fear God, serve him, follow him. Watch this. And it says this. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, verse 16, as you tested him at Massah. You shall diligently keep the commands of the Lord your God and his testimonies and his statutes, which he has commanded you. And you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may go well with you, and that you may go in and take possession of the good land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers, by thrusting out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has promised. You see what he's saying? Saying, listen, man, be diligent in keeping God's commands, God's statutes, and God's testimonies. Don't stop talking about what God has done. Why? Why would you keep God's testimonies? Watch, here it is. Verse 20, it's so beautiful. And when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules of the Lord our God has commanded you? See what the boy's doing now? He's looking to dad and he's going, dad, I got a question for you. Looks like you kind of just live following God in a culture that's serving all sorts of other things. And it looks like you're sort of fixed on that. And you keep talking about God and talking about what he's done. And you keep teaching us these things. What is the point, dad? I mean, look at the culture around us. There's lots of good things in this culture we could pursue. And if we pursued those gods, with those gods come some pleasures and some things that are cool, right? The boy's asking, God, dad, why don't we just roll the dice and risk the board? Look, the board's open. We can take it now. And if we take it now, we can dominate the world. And then dad goes, shh. I'll tell you exactly why. I'll tell you why we don't risk everything for the wrong things, but that we diligently follow the commands of God for righteousness' sake and land in the right things. Watch, look how dad answers. This is what God tells us to answer as dads. Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders and great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. You see, he says, those who pursue the cultural norms, they end up in disaster. But he set us free from that pursuit so that we could be free to live lives that pursue God. And he has brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he has sworn to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always. Do you see what dad's doing? This, son, is the life. This is the life that makes you a man. This is the life that rises you up into greatness. This is the pursuit that matters. Do not pursue the things of this world, but stick with God, and it will be for all of our good. That he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commanded before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. See what God's saying to us men? He's redefining manhood for us through the gospel eyes. Since Jesus rescued your soul, restored your purpose to be a man that demonstrates the gospel through every arena of life, you are invited back into an adventure greater than you could have imagined in fatherhood. Yesterday morning, I was home with six of my kids. Two of them had gone with mom. My two 13-year-old daughters had gone with my wife to go and buy some new bathing suits and clothes because they're going on the student ministries camp this week and they're 13. And so they're like, okay, we got to get ready for the trip. So mom said, let's go figure some stuff out. So they went off and I had the other six kids home. And my two younger daughters, Hope and Rahel, they're 9 years old. And they came to me and I'm busy working on some stuff and I'm in the middle of some things. I've got a list my wife gave me and I've got a list that I need to do for the week coming and I'm preparing for the message today. And I'm working through it, and my daughters come and say, Dad, can we have a tea party? And I think, oh, this is perfect. I let them do a tea party, they'll be distracted for an hour, and I won't have to deal with all of that craziness that comes with them being bored. So I go, yes, grab the tea stuff and go out and do a tea party. So they go out and they start setting up outside on the patio, and I realize this tea party is going to be a big deal because they're not setting up for two like I thought they would, they're setting up for six. And I'm going, oh, they've got a plan. The boys are upstairs playing Wii right now, and they're going to go upstairs and tell the boys, tea party! And the boys are going to go, Wii tea party. Wii tea party. Ha! That's what's going to happen. And it's going to turn into a big disappointing mess is what's going to occur. I already knew it. So right away, the girls come in and say, Dad, would you make us some tea? So I'm like, I will. And I'm going to put honey in the tea too, because I knew if they put honey in the tea, when they go upstairs and they say, there's honey in the tea, that might be an incentive to draw at least my six-year-old out of the mix, because he goes for anything sweet. And so I'm like, okay. So they go upstairs and that's exactly what happens. Rahel goes upstairs. She tells the boys. Cole comes running down, honey tea. And the other three boys are like, are you kidding me? So she comes down and she goes, Dad, the boys want to come now. I'm like, honey, you know what? It's okay. Boys don't really do the tea thing real well. But Dad will come to tea with you. I'll come have tea with you. And I said this, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to pull some chocolate chip cookies out. We're going to have chocolate chip cookies, but don't tell the boys upstairs. When they find out later on that they missed the tea and they missed the chocolate chip cookies, they can pay that price all by themselves. So I get the chocolate chip cookies out. Cole is thrilled. He's like, honey tea and chocolate chip cookies. Yes, I made the right choice. But his entire motivation wasn't caring for his sisters. It was chocolate chip cookies. So I know that. And down the stairs comes strolling my 15-year-old son, Birhanu. Comes down and he comes out and Rahel informs me that he said he would join the tea party. Now this is an interesting moment because he was playing Wii as well. But I remembered back that the last time there was an incident like this a few months ago, the boys kind of made fun of the girls, particularly my younger boys. And so I had a talk with all my boys about the fact that these are things that matter to girls and they matter a great deal and they make the girls feel special and like princesses. And it is our job as men to make sure we feed those things instead of feeding their insecurities. I didn't do it in that language, but I talked through what it looked like to be great brothers and to step in when we needed to. And apparently, my 15-year-old son took that to heart. So he comes downstairs. He is not motivated by honey tea or chocolate chip cookies. He knew of neither. And he came and sat down at the table outside with us and took his little flowery cup and sipped away at his little flowery tea and ate his little chocolate cookie and talked with the girls. And his two sisters sat there proud as can be that they were serving tea to us, pouring our tea and doing our thing. When we walked inside, I called my son over and I said, Birhanu, I want to tell you something, buddy. That was awesome. That was being a man. That was saying that it matters more that I stand and protect and honor the hearts of my sisters than it does that I play another video game. That's what men do not understand in our culture. And you are learning that at 15, and you are already a man now. And one day when you become a dad and a husband, you will know that it makes you a man when you sacrifice what the world tells you is cool so that you can be there for your children, for your sons and your daughters. And when the world looks at you and says, psh, are you kidding me? You're hanging home on Saturday with the kids? We're playing golf, dude. You got to come. Or as a movie night, come on. And you go, no, I'm gonna be home with the kids. I already work a lot. I'm just going to. The culture may look at you and go, you're just a pansy, man. But that's because the culture doesn't know what on earth they're talking about. God says that if you're going to be a man, then you express fatherhood. And anytime the expression of fatherhood appears, do you feel redemption there too? That story I just told you about Birhanu, did that feel wrong? Did that feel redemptive and beautiful and powerful? It should, because it was. See, the gospel is made known when we act as fathers. Whether we are actually biologically fathers or not is not the point. The point is whenever we choose as men to represent fatherhood to the fatherless or to our own children, then we represent the gospel well and we become men, men of God. So may I invite you again, remind you perhaps. I know you love your kids. Don't worry, I don't doubt that because I love mine. But I struggle with the balance of having to work and having to move forward and having to provide. It's complicated for us men. It's not an easy thing. But may I just invite you back into focusing on this, that your kids are your grandest adventure. And the more you pour into them, the cooler it's going to get. Yes, at first when you risk for that, it will look like you're going to lose the risk game. Because you'll be sitting right here in Africa while everybody else is covering the board. But don't worry. They will soon thin out, and when they do, only you will remain standing. Because those who walk in the ways of the Lord and those who are men of God, they will not be shaken, they will not falter, they will stand firm. And that's who we want to be. That's who we are invited to be. So may you and I walk out of here this week, and may we as men put more energy and time once again into reading and learning and blogging and videoing and growing in what it means to love our sons and love our daughters. May we study up, may we engage, and may we be more available than ever. And if we have to pay a price in some of the other arenas of our life, may we do it because we understand that the adventure of being fathers is the greatest adventure of all. And ladies, children, we need you to speak into our lives the gospel. We are confronted daily by a culture that tells us what makes us important is how much we are advancing in our careers and how much stuff we're collecting. They tell us that every day. The lie is loud and bold. And we need you not to be disappointed in us when we blow it, but to be encouraging to us to say, there's a grander adventure for you. Thanks for giving a little. Thanks for giving more than you did yesterday. Thanks for being part of this. You are a godly man. I see greatness in you. Don't buy into what that world's telling you, but come and linger with us. We love you. We want you here. Be gracious toward us. We are fighting hard for you, even though some days it doesn't seem like it. It's complicated for us, but we love you with all our hearts, and we're trying. Help us. Happy Father's Day. Let's pray. God, would you rise up in us and do great things in us, men. Remind us that our grandest adventure is to follow hard after you, fix our eyes on you, follow your ways, and then teach those ways through living them and speaking them into our sons and daughters and their sons and daughters. Remind us that as men, we are given the grand privilege of representing fatherhood, the very thing you called yourself, and that we can represent the gospel in extraordinary ways as dads. To all those here, all those men, whether they're 13 or 15, 25, 95, God, would you remind them that fatherhood is born every time they sacrifice themselves to honor the heart of a woman or the heart of a child. That this is when they are men. And when they pay a price for that, it is an awesome thing. In the land of freedom where we no longer have to pursue the wind and chase after the things that we think will make us valuable, would you set us free to pour ourselves wholeheartedly into the things that would advance our children and our families, to be more like you, to live more on mission, to be dangerous and uncomfortable for the sake of the gospel, and to change the world. Make it so, Father, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.